Accession number 10613, rule 16.
Charles Burton Taylor, Reel 16. While you were doing these preparations and starting the tunnel, it seems strange that the Germans didn't actually discover such things as the eaves were full of soil, they didn't check underneath the huts, that this sort of thing could... How was it, do you think?
Well, I think that they had a fairly, what can I say, deliberate or narrow-minded idea about searching. I'd say, relative to the stuff in the eaves, they probably didn't think about it. Other than that, they would have thought, no doubt, well, we must check up on whether anyone's drawing maps or anyone digging. They might have looked around the area to see whether we were dropping it off, spoil, and possibly instructed the guards to keep an eye open in that direction. But other than that, they seem to, I think I mentioned it earlier, they would come round on a search, and they'd be searching for hollow sounds in the floor, in case of a tunnel, or they'd come round and possibly pick up somebody who was drawing a map, or the next time it would be a question of searching our kit and our lockers. And other than that, they just wandered, not consistently, but at odd times round the camp, picking up presumably what sounds or sights they could pick up.
How far had you got underground before things went wrong?
That's taxing the memory, but I would say probably, I think about 15 or 20 feet out. We hadn't made the wire, that's for sure.
So how did they discover these various things? You mentioned they discovered the food at the bottom of the sand.
Yeah, once again, going back to this, where they come out to do one check, and on this occasion it wasn't claws and it wasn't maps, it was the fire sandboxes, which, since this was a fire regulation, we didn't reckon that they would tip the things out. But sure enough, on this occasion, they were tipping all the sandboxes out, and of course our saved-up food was discovered and taken away.
Was there any punishment?
Not on that, because they didn't basically know. I suppose they could have punished the whole bungalow, but they didn't know exactly who's... These were little blocks of the food that we'd made up, rather like the old-fashioned emergency rations, like blocks of chocolate. And they wouldn't know who had set them there, except somebody in the bungalow, but they didn't punish the whole bungalow.
I believe you actually managed to get them back.
Yes. I personally felt, and I think we all felt, that it was terribly sad we'd lost all this saved-up food. And so I suggested and had it agreed that I could go through the wire and tell them a story about what we did in Newcastle during race week, which was a big fete week on our local town moor, and say that what we used to do was to have fun and throw eggs and have a picnic, and we decided we'd do the same sort of thing. In this case, we'd saved up our food. And the security officer was a Rittmeister Knapp, who was one of the old school, and Rittmeister meaning riding master, a cavalry chap, and I think had a greater sympathy than some of the other people. But with a bit of a twinkle in the eye, he said that, of course, it wasn't used for escaping, was it? And, of course, I vehemently said no. And anyway, cutting a long story short, he finally said, well, we'll have to grind it down just in case there are any... knives or files or north, south, east, west items inside, which was what was done, and we finally got it back and we made it up into blocks again and ate it.
You didn't attempt to keep it for escaping again?
Not at that time, no.
Now, they eventually also discovered the tunnel, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, that we thought was rather a dirty trick, because mind you, when you think of it, it might be a fairly obvious way to discover a tunnel. I think they must have had some inkling, because they just came to the end one day of the end of our bungalow, and dug their own ditch round, and of course then they came upon the tunnel. And at that time, actually, I was in bed with a bit of a cough, and up came the floorboards in front of me, and of course that was that. So that tunnel was one that went bust.
Well, what did it do?
After that, it was a question of interrogation, and my chap, Major Fred Mead, I think in all sincerity, since he was of the room and also the bungalow commander, said that he accepted responsibility, and I think his idea was rather generous, because I think he wanted not to involve anybody else, knowing full well, as the bungalow commander, he would probably be held responsible. But I think that was rather sad, because he was promptly sent off to another camp, which I believe was a Straflager, which regarded as a punishment camp. We didn't really know what happened, but he was certainly sent away. One or two of us were also interrogated on the other side of the wire and asked all sorts of questions. And as far as I was concerned, I stuck to the Geneva thing of the rule that all you need give is your number, rank and name.
What sort of questions were they asking you?
Just what had I seen? How was I affected? Was I concerned with this escape? And what part had I taken in it? And it was very tempting to say that, because one thing we did see from our window was the night raids, I think on Mulheim or somewhere anyway, locally, but I think that was courting disaster. But they also asked, which I resented, home address and my wife's name. And that caused a slight hiatus, which almost meant, I think it was a captain interrogating through an interpreter. But when he'd asked me for my wife's name for about the sixth time, and I said, well, you know, my wife's got nothing to do with it, and that was repeated through the interpreter. And finally I said, oh, well, my wife's name is Mrs. Burton Taylor. And unfortunately an interpreter chuckled at this and was very promptly asked why, and he translated Mrs. Burton Taylor, which was not really acceptable as far as this captain. And I got the answer back that if he had his way, I would talk. So I think that was the only verbal threat I've ever had. But it could have been obvious, who knows.
And what happened after the interrogation?
After that, nothing. We were returned the...
Were you put in solitary then?
No, because as far as I was concerned, I'd admitted nothing. And none of the other people admitted anything at all. And basically, I think that they reckoned okay. We haven't got a case. That's another thing, that they're in a way consistent, in a way non-consistent, because they knew jolly well that we must know about it being in the same room. But if they say, right, the rule says you must have evidence, well, they didn't get the evidence as far as anybody else was concerned. And Fred, in his own way, Major Fred Mead, in fact, signed an acceptance of responsibility, which is a great pity. But I think he did it with the best of intentions for the rest of the people.
So, back into the camp. What happened then? Did you carry on your escape attempts? Or?
No, I think from that time Fred went away. I think we've got to the point of... I'm trying to remember dates. I think by this time we not only had D-Day, but there was the obvious fact that the Russians were advancing. These prepared withdrawals by the Jerry, which we got in the press, which rather hinted that they were pulling back and back and back, that it wouldn't be all that long before we'd all be out. So there was no, not in our group anyway, from memory, any great saying, we must start again. I think that about that time I went in was into the local, you know, the MI room or the mini hospital in the camp with a touch of bronchitis.
Do you think that was brought on by the cold or the conditions, or was it just one of those things?
I think it's just one of those things, really. But touch wood, I don't think I had anything. Probably everyone has said this to you, that basically we were always short of everything, food, clothing, and so on. And, but, you know, the body survives on relatively little.
How were you treated in the camp hospital? Was it?
Oh, well, it was run by us, so no problem, and our own doctors. Very crowded, but
how many patients did you count with, roughly?
Well, roughly, I would say, probably about 60 to 80, I think, something like that, because it was the same size hut as we had the 120 in, but of course we didn't have double-decker beds.
Did you have the drugs and such like that were necessary?
As far as I know, there was no problem there. I don't remember anyone saying that we are short of this, that or the other.
Now, you were made an offer while you were there of a holiday camp, wasn't it?
Oh, I see, yes. It wasn't, well, yes, I suppose it was an offer. It came through the usual channels, through the SBO and so on, that if people wanted to go, and I think it was hinted at the question of anyone who was, I mean, some people almost literally went to their beds and, what can you say, gave up and, I suppose, in a mild way, went around the bend. But it was, I think, aimed for those sort of people, or for people like myself who had been in hospital for a while. A number of people really raised one hell of an objection and said we didn't want any favours from the jury. I personally didn't subscribe to that one, because if, in fact, it was going to be a fitness or some attempt to be able to get or keep fit, if you like, then I must confess I wasn't against it.
What exactly had they offered you? They'd
offered... Well, there was just the question of... I don't know whether they referred to it as a convalescent camp, but another camp where there would be more space, not so much more freedom, except that when we got there, one had to very much walked out on parole. But since we did that in the main camp, there really wasn't much different there, because you were under guard. I mean, you didn't go out on your own.
What was the name of this convalescent?
This place was at Schlossburg, which was northeast of Munich. And it was a small, very small Schloss, not the sort of thing... pinnacle on the top of a hill. It was really a small country home, I would say. And I think there roughly were about 40 of us. The accommodation was much better. We had more room. We were allowed to go out and fell trees to give us a great extra heat and that sort of thing. There was an adequate supply of Red Cross parcels and therefore cigarettes. And we were in a far more civilised... We were more like, in a way, being in a... I'd say almost an officer's mess. Because we sat around in tables, with nice chairs and so on. And I think we were there a fortnight. Snow on the ground, sunshine. Beginning of 45, this was. And so we really were not very fit walking and sawing these trees down. Yes, once we were there, we'd rather an unusual thing. The tenor, Hans Hotti, who we discovered, in fact, had married an English girl from Nottingham. We were told that we would be entertained by him, and also, I think, by a pianist. And so it happened. And in this small, confined space, he had a magnificent voice. But it really almost bent the walls. But it was a tremendous change from we didn't really have much. Well, we didn't have any self-entertainment. There was no question of the sort of theatre that we had in the main camp. So this extra entertainment was a very welcome change. And just as an afterthought, we were told that we couldn't really pay him or do anything. But if we wished to express our appreciation, then possibly some spare soap or perhaps some spare chocolate could be left behind the curtains on a certain shelf. And of course, since we all had quite a lot here, that was what we did. I also got the biggest rocket, I think, of my life, which I think was unjustified.
What was that?
We did our stint one morning as I say, it's magnificent, snow-covered area, beautiful sunshine, and we'd done our tree chopping, and then I think about four of us went out spare for an extra walk with one of the guards, which was quite normal, and we signed our little pass saying that we wouldn't escape. And the guard suggested that we might like to go into the farmhouse on the way back and have something to eat. Well, food was always a thing, even though we were doing very well. And we had this Kenny farmer's wife cook up some meat, not much meat, but a lot of fried potato, which was something rather nice. And, of course, we were late back into camp. Well, perhaps the guard, he might have got a bollocking too, but apparently I was the senior of the four, and I was yanked up before the colonel who commanded the senior British officer, and giving a right round ticking off for having deviated. Personally, I thought it was a bit unfair, and on top of that, I rather felt that he, in running that camp, was sitting on a pretty good number.
He was
himself.
Permanent
there, was he? Well, as far as I was concerned, yes. He didn't move in with us. He was there anyway for a while.
When you gave your parole for these walks, and there were four of you and one guard, did it ever cross your mind, I mean, at earlier times as well, did it ever cross your mind to break parole?
No. No, I think that some people, in fact, refused to give it, and of course didn't get their walks. And I think that would be appropriate anywhere in any camp. But no, I think the main thing is that if you to get out of the camp was rather fun, any camp, and okay, if you promised not to escape, then you could get out of the camp. The other side of the coin is that in getting outside of the camp, you could study a little bit of the ground, you know, what can I say, possible approaches or escape routes away from the camp. So you could glean a bit of knowledge of the local countryside.
Was the reason you didn't break parole, I mean, was it a matter of honour, or was it or was it combined with the fact that if you did break it, then everybody would lose this opportunity?
Yep. No, that really, well, if you like, a combination of honour as well. On the other hand, if it had been just an individual breaking parole, I have a feeling that one might have said, well, all's fair in love and war. On the other hand, if you were, shall we say, caught out doing that, you would well, what can I say, find yourself being called worse than muck, and you'd have to admit that, you know, being a little bit of a naughty boy. And I think the main thing is that it would have had an effect on everybody else's well-being. Like also, at Weinsberg, we used to be able to go out and play rugby on... we had, in fact, an international match, England versus Scotland, if I remember rightly, at Weinsberg. And this was well away from the camp and open space. Well, I mean, we cheered and we all played. And so it's really getting away from the atmosphere of the camp, which was good for everyone.
You were at Schlossberg for about 2 weeks, you
said. I think that's something like that, yeah.
And then back to Weinsberg.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask was, this is late in the war. Had you come across or had any experience of concentration camps at this time? Not obviously, you weren't in one,
no.
But did you have any knowledge of what the Germans were doing to the Jewish population?
No. Not as far as I personally was concerned, whether anybody else had. I think the only thing that there was a hint, we had one, I can't remember his name, but there was one Jew. In the camp, and I understand that there was some question of if there was ever any question of us being illegally moved, or if there's any, no, the other side of the coin, I think, really, is that if there's any question of him being taken out as an individual, then we proposed that we were going to hide him. And that's the nearest I can think. And the reason was that he was a Jew. But nobody came out full blast and said, because any Jew is likely to be bumped.
Did you ever see any signs in your travels, any signs of the concentration camps or of the Jewish trains,
not the trains. On the other hand, I do recall that on this trip to or from Schlossburg, where for once we were in, my God, they were antiquated, but at least there were carriages, you know, with windows, and it wasn't the question of going by a cattle truck. And we pulled into a small town which had been bombed, and there there were men in the usual pyjama, striped pyjama things, and we saw one set literally carrying, shall we say, one piece of floorboard about 10 foot wide and 10 foot long, I mean, and 6 inches wide, just really walking like automatons, being whipped to try and get them moving more quickly. Absolutely white in the face, and really made one a bit sick to see this. At the other side, where we were on one line that had been restored through the station area, and in the bombing areas there were a lot of men digging and clearing up, and it came to food time, and if you could imagine a sort of box about the size of a dozen tin boxes, cardboard brought up, and sliced sausage, and just chucked out like feeding chickens, and of course it was a scramble just to get these bits of food. That made us a bit sick. But
did you know, you didn't realise who they were, you presumably couldn't?
Well, the we understood this idea of these people in pyjamas, but I think there was a certain amount of mention of this before the war, but I didn't literally hear about it in the camps. But if you remember, or you may remember from history, the bashing up of Jewish shops and so on in Germany, which went on before the war.
So you got back to Winesburg, it's after Christmas now.
Yep.
Well, it's yep, in 1945, right. January, February.
Yeah.
What was the mood in the camp?
I think the... Well, the first thing, just digressing slightly, was that whilst we were away, the commandant apparently had been approached, and would we help harvest some fields of leeks? And the senior British officers really basically refused, because officers don't work anyway, and it would be helping the German economy. And then I presume somebody either suggested or he changed and said, well, if we can have half... which would mean that we would get some fresh vegetables, which we hadn't seen other than potatoes, which were pretty ropey. We'd get some fresh vegetables, and that was allowed. And frankly, by the time we'd left there, I thought I'd never look another leek in the face, because we got leeks with everything. But it was good for us. But I think the mood was just when. It was quite obvious that the end of the war was approaching pretty quickly. And the big thought was, where are they going to move us? And that, I think, was in everybody's mind, and what we would do if we were moved. From that, we were told that we were going to be moved, and that the train would, you know, we'd be put in a train at Winesburg station. The senior British officer said, well, he would not move under any circumstances unless the tops of the cattle trucks could be painted in white, POW, so that we would avoid being shot up. Because by now we had aircraft over, not just the bombers which used to go over, you know, for months and months beforehand, but now we were having fighter planes over. And we had some fighter bombers, and they missed the flipping train, which annoyed us intensely. They damaged Winesburg station a little bit, but we hoped that they would bust up the train. Then I think the time came that we had to move, and we were bundled into the trains. In the meantime, we had been firing at the corner of the camp. How the heck we got away with it, I don't know. The rubbish bins, the idea being that once the smoke failed to be coming up, from the air, they would note that that camp had been evacuated, so it would give a hint as to what had happened to us. And we were then...
How far away were the Allies?
Ah, no.
About?
I don't know. It could be, 10, 15, 20 miles. I mean, by now we were
here. Shelling.
We were hearing, that's the point I was going to say, we could hear the shelling. But, shelling noise can carry quite quite considerably.
So you lugged it into the...
Into the cattle trucks, yeah. And they did allow us to paint. The night before we actually moved, they allowed some PWs to go down and paint the roofs of the cattle trucks. Then we moved, and by night to start with, and then they parked the engine in the tunnel, and we had to stop with the engine parked in the tunnel to, so it wouldn't be shot up. And of course, PW roofs, thank God we weren't shot up. And we just really waited until we then moved on. And we finally had to go through back to Moosburg again. And it wasn't really any incident on the way, just a question of getting in and out. One change, perhaps, is that in coming into Germany, we were guarded by well-equipped soldiers. By now, we were... in fact, we used to help take the rifle from the Volkssturm fellow. This was the last dregs, really. Their uniform was an armband. And I can remember to this day saying, well, you know, give us your rifle, chum. And take his rifle and then help him up. And he was supposed to be guarding us.
He's an old man.
Oh, very much an old man. Oh, yes, yes. No, this was very near the end. And...
You had no, for that reason, there was no thought of escape. You felt you'd be better off.
Well, that was very much a moot point. We discussed, there was a lot of discussion because there were a lot of things, we used to get odd bits of propaganda from them in the camps. We got one, escaping is now no longer a British sport. The diabolical terror bombing of the population, anyone who's caught, it's unlikely that they would live, and so on and so forth. There are all sorts of hints that you shouldn't, because you might really get your throat slit, and so on, by the civilian population, so you could guarantee no help. So the conversations went backwards and forwards. We decided to stay put. I believe one or two people did hide up and really awaited for whoever was coming, and in our case, the Americans. But for my group, we went into Moosburg, in a way, back to square one. On that, well, we just decided that was the best thing to do.
Now, this is a camp of all nationalities.
Again, yes.
What state was the camp in?
Not a bad state, really. The only thing is that it might have been a sign of the times that we were ushered into a barrack block, these self-same huts. And through a room at the end, which just in the corner, just heaped a pile, not folded or anything like that, blankets, and told to take a couple of blankets each, and make our own way into the body of the hut, where we, there are no beds or anything like that, and we just lay on the floor. And for the first 24 hours, we couldn't really... I've never been so covered with flea bites. But I think I mentioned earlier that I think after 24 hours, the flea bites disappeared. Neither our blood wasn't good enough for them, or for some reason they just didn't... Or perhaps they died.
Was this the first time you'd had problems with lice?
As far as I'm concerned, certainly, yep.
So, what sort of food were you on at this time? Because the whole journey was in a right state.
That's right. Well, oddly enough, we seemed to get certain basic food that this time they had allowed white trucks, big trucks, to come in from Switzerland with Red Cross parcels. And we were getting one parcel ahead. And from that point of view, we were basically very adequately fed. The main reason was very great care had to be to not to eat too much, because I think one fellow died, actually, not in our group, but I just heard that, because he got so excited about getting a full parcel that he almost scoffed it off in one go.